This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Ngunnawal country. Across New South Wales and Victoria, multiple towns are on edge as floodwaters rise. In northern New South Wales, the SES says there's unlikely to be major flooding, although Lismore will face moderate flooding. Much further south, the twin towns of Echuca and Moama on the Victoria-New South Wales border are facing the worst flooding in decades as the Murray surpasses the 1993 flood level and continues rising. The predicted flood peak continues to be delayed, which is magnifying the anxiety and frustration for some locals whose homes remain under threat. Gavin Coote reports.
Dawn Thompson's home in Moama is fortified by thousands of sandbags and a concrete levee. The 91-year-old is checking on her animals every few hours as the swollen Murray River keeps rising just metres from her house.
I've only got chooks and a dog. Oh, and a cockatoo. He couldn't forget him. When he hears you talk, away he goes. He's over 60 years old.
Hello.
Floodwaters in the Murray are the highest in more than 30 years. Some homes in Moama already have water in them. Dawn Thompson's hoping the levee won't be breached.
I just hope it doesn't come over the bank, but we all hope that.
And you've lived in this house for about 40 odd years?
Oh, yes, it would be, I think. Yeah.
Have you ever seen this amount of water around the house?
No. This is the worst that I've seen.
Four generations of Dawn Thompson's family are helping protect the house. Her daughter Rhonda is among them.
Yeah, I've been here for a week tomorrow, isn't it, Mum? Something like that, yeah. And it's going to peak and it's going to peak and they keep moving it back and back, but the Shire and the emergency services, they're pitching in and checking they check the bank the whole night.
On the Victorian side of the Murray, in Echuca, it's a nervous wait as the flood level creeps further up the makeshift levee, stretching 2.5 kilometres. Sandbags surround many homes, just in case the river tops the levee. Glenn Ogden's been waiting days for the peak to come and reckons everyone's in limbo.
I'm calmer than I was. I was panicking a fair bit because I knew it was supposed to peak on Saturday. It hasn't. Then it was supposed to peak on Sunday. It hasn't. They're saying Monday. So while those days get pushed back, that's better for us, because there's breaks in the river downstream from here to Shepparton, and a lot of that water is spreading, which is really bad for those people, but it's better for us.
Even if the Murray River doesn't breach the levee, there's the constant threat of stormwater gathering on the other side and threatening homes.
There's a ravine on my side of the levee bank. It's fairly big, but when it rains, the water's got nowhere to go. So if we get inches of rain, that'll fill up. They'll start the pumps, but the pump won't be able to keep up.
And is it of some assurance that you've got council staff now manning that around the clock, that pump?
Yes, we have. One will come, they'll be there pretty much all day. Into the night, they're keeping a close check on it.
And when the floodwaters do peak, they're expected to remain at major flood levels for days.
Gavin Coote reporting. Brendan Moon is the Coordinator General for the National Emergency Management.
Right now, our focus is very much on those communities that will expect a major flood peak over the coming days, which could cause significant inundation to their homes, especially around northwestern Victoria, those communities on the Murray, including Kerrang, Moama, Echuca, and also previously Shepparton, which has seen the peak, but we still understand there are more homes that have been impacted by this event.
This will be a slow-moving disaster lasting for weeks, possibly months. Is there any more preparation that can be done right now to lessen the impact and the damage bill, especially along the Murray and other river communities?
There have been warnings from the Bureau for months now that this year would be a particularly challenging year. But given the scale of this and the repeat nature of the events that keep coming through and adding to those river systems, it is putting a strain on all response agencies and all the recovery agencies. But what we are seeing is a fantastic effort from the community, from many government agencies at all levels, local, state and also Commonwealth, to deal with these events, but also recognising that we still have a long summer to go.
Yeah, as you mentioned, there is a long summer to go, and given that the strain is lasting for a long time, the government is apparently considering a semi-professional emergency response workforce of people who can be called upon to do this kind of work instead of relying on defence personnel, for example. Does that idea have merit?
Well, if you consider that since 2019, since the Black Summer bushfires, our response, our recovery agencies, our communities have essentially been responding to major natural disasters, be they bushfires, be they floods, be they cyclones. And last week when I was in Western New South Wales, there were communities that I met that had been flooded four or five times this year already. So I think as a nation, if we are going to be able to continue to be able to respond and also recover effectively to these events and also to the increasing frequency and also nature of these events, I think it has merit that we need to develop further capabilities to not only support response but also that longer term recovery.
You've been in this job for just on a month. You've worked with the Queensland Reconstruction Authority before then. Have you had time to think about how much more effort should go into planning resilience programs and building better infrastructure to better handle a warming planet and more frequent extreme weather?
We all recognise that investing in resilience has significant benefit to the community. The key is, though, is that we will not flood-proof or fire-proof the entire nation. We must take a strategic and targeted approach to those most vulnerable areas and target our investment in the short term in those particular places. So we'll certainly be looking at the development of regional resilience strategies and also state and national resilience strategies that will highlight where the most effective investment can take place to start to future-proof those communities against climate change and also against our current weather patterns.
So perhaps more permanent levees to be built and perhaps a conversation about restricting home construction in flood zones as well?
I think these sorts of events that we're currently experiencing always trigger an important conversation for us about where we build and what we build. And for some communities, levees and other structural mitigation options are a real viable option. However, for others, they're not. And so they must look at other ways. It could be the way they build their homes. It could be the land use planning issues that exist in some of those catchments. So I think there are a whole range of mitigation options we should be considering, depending on where you are in Australia.
Brendan Moon, thanks for talking to AM.
Thank you, Sabra.
And Brendan Moon is the Coordinator General for National Emergency Management. The Albanese government's delivering its first budget tomorrow night, with Labor determined to show how it's delivering on its election promises, but it's also under pressure to show spending restraint. It's found about $10 billion in so-called savings from axing, redirecting or delaying some projects. Political reporter Stephanie Boris explains.
In Sydney's west, the busy Homebush Bay Drive roundabout is notorious for its high rate of crashes.
What the f***?
The Morrison government promised $50 million for an upgrade. Fiona Martin was the local Liberal MP at the time.
This means that we're one step closer to a solution for Australia's worst roundabout.
But the Albanese government's first budget is delaying funding the project until the middle of 2025. It's a similar story in Queensland. $800 million earmarked by the Coalition for the Rockhampton Ring Road is being put off for a few years. National Senator Bridget McKenzie says truckies and motorists can't wait any longer.
Our roads need to be actually up for the task, which is getting product to port. Not to mention, as a local, getting your kids to school or to football or netball.
A shortage of workers, rising inflation and a lack of supplies are some of the government's reasons for delaying projects like these, but it's also a way of finding some cash in the short term. There are changes to $6.5 billion of infrastructure projects over the next 10 years, most of which are having funding delayed. Linda Scott is the president of the Australian Local Government Association.
We know that there's an urgent need for an investment in local infrastructure, whether that be roads or community centres, and that funding should be brought forward, not delayed.
Tomorrow's budget will include about $10 billion in savings. Another $11 billion will be reprioritised, meaning cash is being moved from one project to another. Bridget McKenzie is worried about those changes.
What the National Party wants to see, and I think what the 9 million regional Australians want to see, no matter who they voted for, is that not $1 is redirected from the regions into capital cities.
The government claims it will save nearly $4 billion by reducing spending on external contractors, advertising, travel and legal expenses, while another $2 billion worth of grants will be cut. Linda Scott is keen to see the detail.
Where there are government funding programs that seek to pork barrel and only selectively fund councils, councils find it very difficult. That's why we always advocate for fair and transparent funding.
Projects being scrapped include a commuter car park in Hurstville in Sydney South, just one of dozens promised by the Coalition, and two road projects in the Liberal-held Melbourne seat of Aston. Nearly $500 million for a train line through Monash in the marginal Melbourne seat of Chisholm is also off the table. The government hopeful that cutting projects it considered to be pork barrelling will actually win voter support in the years ahead.
Stephanie Boris. The race to become the next UK Prime Minister is heating up, with former Chancellor Rishi Sunak formally declaring he's running to become leader of the Conservative Party. Penny Mordaunt has also thrown her hat into the ring. Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports.
To get on the ballot, candidates for the leadership need to be nominated by at least 100 Tory MPs. Rishi Sunak is the only candidate so far who seems to have reached that threshold. Boris Johnson's camp claims he has enough backers, even though he's only had around 50-odd public endorsements. The UK's business secretary, Jacob Rees-Mogg, says he is sure he will run and get support.
Clearly he is going to stand. There's a great deal of support for him, as you will have seen. The system is that the proposer and seconder's names are made public. Other people have a choice as to whether to make their names public or not. But the people who are doing the numbers for Boris's campaign tell me that they have the numbers. So the 100 that is necessary of members of parliament are there.
Many consider it unthinkable that Boris Johnson could be a contender. Just months ago, he was forced to resign after nearly 60 ministers and parliamentary secretaries refused to serve under him. And he remains under investigation by Parliament's Privileges Committee over whether he misled the House of Commons over lockdown parties held in and around Downing Street. Conservative Minister Steve Baker says that alone should disqualify him from running.
Boris is an amazing figure in our party, an incredible campaigner. He lights up any room. People absolutely love him. And if he were, say, chairman of the party, in charge of our campaigning, he could be an incredible asset. But the problem is, as Prime Minister, we would be absolutely shackled to somebody who was bound to bring us down.
Rishi Sunak has at least 140 Tory MPs who've publicly endorsed him, and in the past 24 hours has gained a number of key backers from across the political spectrum within his party. Among them is backbencher Tobias Elwood.
It's absolutely critical. And when you get people like myself and Steve Baker, Kemi Badenoch and Suella Braverman as well, all coming together to support Rishi Sunak, that shows the party is wishing to unite, recognising, though, that if we're not united, then we are divided. And if we're divided, as I say, we don't govern well.
The nominations need to be in on Monday at 2 p.m. local time. If only one candidate gets over 100 nominations, they will automatically become Prime Minister. If there's more than one, it will go to an online ballot for party members, and there'll be a new leader decided on by the end of the week. This is Steve Kinnane reporting from London for AM.
And an update to that. Boris Johnson has confirmed he's pulled out of the leadership race, saying it's simply not the right thing to do. Analysts say long-term relations with China will remain complicated after the country's leader Xi Jinping solidified his control over the weekend. East Asia correspondent Bill Birdles reports.
69-year-old Xi Jinping emerging first through the doors and onto the stage in Beijing's Great Hall of the People surprised no one. But the six men trailing behind him shocked some observers. All of them are regarded as loyal associates of the leader. Xi's purging of officials from other factions from top positions went beyond most expectations. With no factional rivals or a successor to contend with, Mr. Xi is now being compared to a modern-day emperor.
In the face of new challenges and tests on our new journey, we must be highly vigilant, always maintain a sober outlook, and promote the strict governance of the Communist Party across the board.
Xi's clean sweep of China's cabinet marks the end of just 3 to 4 decades of collective leadership. Dr. Fengming Lu, a lecturer of Chinese politics at ANU, says Mr. Xi has reshaped the cabinet around him.
The way I read is that Xi Jinping is trying to transfer this party in the past 10 years from a board of directors, where there is some institutional means of power sharing, into a more like a team of division managers.
Dr. Liu believes Xi Jinping is locking in for a prolonged rivalry with the United States when he speaks of turbulence ahead. But ties with Australia might improve.
Xi Jinping's main priority is still to deal with the United States. And in this process, actually, he's trying to make more friends rather than make more enemies in the Western camp. But actually, there is still some leeway for the Australian-China relations in the next few years.
Others, though, believe the long-term trend is a Chinese government becoming more difficult to deal with. Alex Joski, a China analyst and author of a new book on Beijing's intelligence operations, says the hardliners are now firmly in control.
Simply no evidence of anyone who's a reformist, anyone who might have more, you know, liberal views in the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. There's no easy way forward for Australia's China relationship, and we're not going to be walking into a future where we can return to more friendly relations.
And that's Alex Joski, analyst and author of a new book on China's intelligence operations, speaking there with Bill Birtles. It's been more than 50 years since it's been legal to hunt saltwater crocodiles in Western Australia, and it almost wiped them out. For a long time, locals in the state's far north have been swimming and fishing in parts of Kununurra's Ord River, as there have been so few salty crocs there. But authorities are now warning their numbers are recovering, and they're worried there's going to be a deadly attack. From Kununurra, Ted O'Connor reports.
Squeezing between spiky pandanus palm trees to set crocodile traps is all in a day's work for Kununurra ranger Tristan Jessel, even if few saltwater crocs are caught.
We only caught one for 3 years ago. It was about 1.10 metres, I think. Yeah, little feisty little fellow.
He's working on a stretch of river known as the Upper Ord, which is above Kununurra's diversion dam.
I see you.
Authorities call it a saltwater crocodile-controlled environment, and it's a place where tourists and locals have long felt safe to swim.
This trap's important because it's close to one of our local swimming places around the corner here.
Downstream at Ivanhoe Crossing, which is the old concrete barrier across the Lower Ord, it's a different story. Mirrawong man Kingsley Malavi says saltwater crocodiles are spotted regularly here, and he's careful around the riverbank.
It's a good place and good country. Watch out for crocs. We've got to, you know, be alert every time.
There are plenty of croc-wise warning signs, but some fishermen and even kids wade out onto the causeway. That worries local wildlife officer Stephen Leader, who estimates there are now about 2,000 saltwater crocodiles in the Lower Ord, double the number there were 5 years ago.
In areas where you might have got away with recreating in the water in a manner that was a bit dangerous, taking some risks, those risks are becoming more and more real and more deadly. People are putting their own lives at risk, and they're people with families and loved ones.
Ecologist Ben Corey says an upcoming crocodile survey is expected to show more of the dangerous reptiles at places like Ivanhoe Crossing, near Kununurra in particular.
Salties were hunted to the brink of extinction across all of northern Australia from unregulated hunting in the 40s, 50s and 60s. And in WA, salties were protected in 1970. As we see crocodile numbers recover from, you know, near extinction, the numbers will sort of stabilise, so they're pretty much just returning to the areas that they would have historically been in.
Crocodile fatalities in the Kimberley are rare, but the saltwater crocodile population is rebounding thanks to good habitat, which includes plenty of barramundi and cattle. Wildlife Officer Stephen Leader says it's clear the risk of an attack is increasing.
It's a real shame to think about the impact what a fatality is going to have on the community, those people's families.
For now, authorities are hoping to avoid the worst with education campaigns and by encouraging locals to use the safer stretch of river.
Ted O'Connor there, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's hard to comprehend just how terrifying it must be living in Ukraine. Russian forces are using missiles and Iranian attack drones to target cities, terrorizing civilians and damaging vital power stations ahead of winter. International investigators are on the ground to document those bombings and other potential war crimes. Today, we speak to one of them. Keep listening to hear ABC News Daily or find the podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.